Forget Russian trolls messing with next year's elections. Our decentralized voting system is its own threat.
So we've got 8,000 at least election jurisdictions in the United States, and in some ways that means we're running 8,000 different elections during a big federal election like a presidential election.
Also, sometimes Russian spies get caught red-handed, and sometimes that's on purpose.
Sometimes you look at the activities of the Russian intelligence services in the West, and you think, wow, these guys are so sloppy. They must be just stupid. And it's not, unfortunately, the case.
Also, here's a new one, a world without time zones.
Everyone in the world would have the same time reading on their watch.
Get ready for dinner at 2 in the morning. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Only 52 weeks to go until we head to the polls to vote for president. That's a solid year of political ads, debates, and name-calling and finger-pointing about which party isn't doing enough to prevent foreign meddling and spreading disinformation on social media. But a Russian troll posing as somebody from Nebraska might be child's play compared to what else could happen. Voter databases and voting machines could be vulnerable. The World's Lydia Amanalidou reports on what's being done to prevent systems from being hacked next year.
First, let's go back to 2016, and let's start inside the Springfield office of the Illinois Board of Elections. So it's mid-July, and
one of our IT people noticed that our system was running extremely slowly. It had practically shut down.
Matt Diedrich is with the State Board of Elections. He's talking about the online voter registration system. The IT person who spotted the abnormality took a closer look.
And he discovered that there was an intruder.
This intruder had gotten into the statewide voter registration database. A vulnerability in the system gave them access to voters' names, addresses, and driver's license numbers.
When we discovered it, we took the entire system down. We notified our attorney general. The FBI came in, then the Department of Homeland Security.
Dietrich says that his agency didn't know who this intruder was at the time. But in July 2018, special counsel Robert Mueller indicted 12 Russian military officers for attempting to interfere with the 2016 presidential election. Dietrich remembers the day the indictment came out. He opened it up on his computer and immediately did a word search for Illinois to see if they were mentioned in the document. They weren't.
But there was a paragraph that described a state board of elections, and it obviously was referring to us. And so we had a press conference that day where we said, you know, this obviously is us. It was extreme. It was terrifying.
It wasn't just Illinois. U.S. officials investigating what Russia did in the lead up to 2016, they say that Russians tried to get into election systems in every single state, all 50 of them. They were successful in Illinois and also in two counties in Florida. Larry Norden directs the election reform program at NYU's Brennan Center, and he says the way we run our elections here in the U.S. makes us vulnerable to cyber attacks.
American elections are very decentralized. So we've got 8,000 at least election jurisdictions in the United States, and in some ways that means we're running 8,000 different elections during a big federal election like a presidential election. And one of the things that we saw in 2016 was that local election offices were clearly a target.
Those local offices often have no IT support, no cybersecurity staff, Norden says. That makes them
a weak link in the election security system and potentially vulnerable to the kinds of attacks that we saw in 2016.
So since then, states have been taking steps to secure their systems. In Illinois, they've hired cybersecurity professionals to work with county clerks across the state. They help monitor and keep their websites, databases, and other systems secure. Other states like Florida are taking similar steps ahead of 2020.
There's a much greater awareness among election officials that security is an extremely important part of their job. There's a much better infrastructure for sharing information among election officials and the federal government.
Norden says all of this is promising because it could help prevent some nightmarish scenarios like
changing information on registration databases that could provide problems for people when they show up to the polls if they want to vote. If it says they already voted or that their address changed, they may have difficulty voting.
Norden says more needs to be done to prevent vulnerabilities in our systems, including our election machines. Many of them are pretty old. They run on outdated software, and they're shockingly easy to hack into. Rachel Toback, who runs a company called Social Proof Security in San Francisco, has done it several times, and she has video to prove it.
I'm very concerned for our upcoming election because this voting machine is used in 18 different states, and it's extremely easy to get admin access on this machine. So let me show you.
This video is from 2018. Toback is at the annual hacking conference DEF CON in Las Vegas. She stands in front of a voting machine.
All they have to do, this bad actor, would be to open up this machine by pressing this button right here.
After a few taps and clicks.
And now I have full admin access under 2 minutes.
At this year's conference, she was able to get into a different voting machine also within minutes.
And I think that's pretty wild. A lot of these attacks, many of them are very complex. But many of them at the same time are actually quite simple.
This is why many election security advocates want to see every polling station in America equipped with a paper ballot backup. According to the Brennan Center, about 12% of Americans will vote without a paper backup in 2020. That's an improvement from 2016, but it's still not enough, says Virginia Senator Mark Warner. He's a Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he wants all polling stations to have a paper ballot backup.
I can't stress enough that this should not be a partisan issue. This should be where Congress acts in the best interest of our democracy.
He says bad actors can weaponize election security gaps in the cyberspace and information space.
In many ways, you don't even have to change actual vote totals. You just need to make Americans believe their system, their votes may not be fully reflected.
And he fully expects bad actors to use social media to stir up doubts about the integrity of the 2020 election. And he says it's not just Russia he's worried about, but also Iran, China, and other actors who have been watching and learning. For The World, I'm Lydia Manulidu.
In Russia, surfing the web just got a lot harder. A new law takes effect there today. It allows the Russian government to increase censorship and isolate Russia from the rest of the web. Here to explain how this would work is Justin Sherman. He's a cybersecurity policy fellow at the New America think tank in Washington.
This is a law that was first proposed in the Russian parliament back in February. It essentially does two main things. The first is give the Russian government greater legal control of the internet service providers and the internet architecture within Russia. And the second main element of the law is encouraging those entities, or in some cases forcing those entities, to take technical measures that will allow the government to isolate the Russian internet. They essentially want to have a switch where if they think the Russian internet needs to be completely cut off, they can do that on the technical level, and so it'll still function internally. People can still communicate, but nothing outside can get in, nothing inside can get out.
So how does this actually work? Say, if you're in Moscow today, what's going to be different from yesterday?
Right now, not really anything. It's one thing to pass a law. It's quite another thing to actually technically execute something as complicated as isolating your country's internet. So while the Russians have started to do some things in this vein, they have not nearly gotten to where they want to be. And so at least for the next few weeks, it really will not look too different, I don't think.
So this is companies have to do this, not individual users?
This has nothing to do with individual user implementation, no. This is the government going to the companies that actually control the physical hardware and the software layers of the internet itself, so that they can isolate information flowing to and from the users on that network.
How does what Russia is doing compare to China's internet firewall?
China and Russia can be compared generally. They both have what we call a sovereign and controlled approach to the internet. They see it as something that needs to be much more managed by the state than we often see in many liberal democracies. But I would argue that that's about where it stops. China's internet strategy is fundamentally oriented towards balancing the economic benefits of internet openness with the political and security benefits of internet control. So it's sort of a tricky wire they try and walk there. Russia's a little bit different because Russia's economy is not nearly where China's is, particularly in the tech sector. And so in Russia, they lean a lot more towards caring about the political and security elements.
I mean, how effective is this likely to be?
That's the key question here. And Russia has struggled, particularly compared to China, which, as you said, is sort of the gold standard of internet filtering. Russia's really struggled to achieve anything near the same level of sophistication and scale. They haven't been doing this as long as the Chinese. The technical capabilities are not there. They don't have the human and financial resources that the Chinese do. For that reason, it's very likely that there are going to be a lot of stumbling blocks.
Is this new law likely to have any impact on Russia's disinformation campaigns?
I would argue yes. They're already doing a lot in this space. Add that to the fact that they might feel more insulated from what the rest of the world can do to them. I think that would only lower their disincentives to do disinformation campaigns and cyber attacks and things of that nature.
Justin Sherman is a cybersecurity policy fellow at the New America Think Tank in Washington, D.C. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a new book prize in town for thrillers, and the nominees couldn't be more different. One is about an intern at an embassy in Turkey. Another one is about a 15th century priest. But one thing they all have in common, there's no violence against women. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The Staunch Prize is now in its second year, and it's the brainchild of British screenwriter Bridget Lawless. She says the idea came out of the Me Too movement and her experience as a voter for the BAFTA Awards, which is like the British Oscars.
I watch a lot of films and I noticed how many featured rape as a backstory or as a main story. And it was quite astonishing, actually. And I wondered what I could do that would be a small scale thing that I could handle myself to try and redress the balance a bit and bring out other exciting, thrilling stories, but without focusing on women as victims.
Still, the prize has drawn criticism, mostly from crime writers. The Scottish crime writer Val McDermid said that not to write about violence against women is to pretend that it's not happening. British writer Sophie Hannah asked her publisher not to submit her books for the award. Other writers call it censorship. Lawless says these authors are missing the point.
What we're doing is celebrating other kinds of stories, making room for them, if you like, in the thriller genre and bringing them to people's attention.
Lawless says violence against women has been a standby of the thriller genre forever. I mean, just think of poor Janet Leigh murdered in the shower at the beginning of Psycho, which was based on a novel of the same name, by the way. Lawless says she's trying to find stories where women aren't attacked just because they're women.
Obviously, men are in violent films and violent books, but they're not attacked because they're men. They're attacked because of something they're doing or some quest they're on or because they're trying to do a big heist or something. And that's the big difference, I think, the way that women are centered in that kind of way in violent fiction.
The Staunch Prize will be awarded on November 25th, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Daylight savings ends this weekend. Don't get thrown off. But here's a possible solution. Abolish time zones altogether. Earlier today, we scheduled an interview with a proponent of this idea, economist Steve Hanke.
Hello.
Hi, is this Steve?
Speaking.
Hi, it's Carol Hills in Boston at The World.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Hi.
How are you, Carol?
Great.
It's 5 here now. I thought we were going to connect in 1 hour from now. And I'm actually with Mrs. Hanke in a store. I'll speak to you in an hour and a half.
Okay, thanks so much. We'll look forward to it.
Yeah, okay, Carol.
Bye.
Thank you.
Yep, that really happened. We'll get our time straight and get back to him later. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Since World War I, Russia has focused on keeping tabs on those who left the country. They were seen as a threat. The Soviets saw them as disloyal. But now, under President Vladimir Putin, many Russian emigres are called compatriots. Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borodogon are investigative reporters based in Moscow and authors of the new book, The Compatriots. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with them about how far back the roots of this go.
When we started researching for this book, we tried to trace the origins of the methods the Russian intelligence uses today dealing with the political exiles in the West. And to our big surprise, we understood that most of these methods you actually can trace back to the 1920s when Lenin died and Cheka, the Russian secret police, became obsessed with people who live abroad. And since then, especially Stalin, he was absolutely obsessed with his political rivals who left the country, who were actually expelled by him.
Interesting. Now, Vladimir Putin gets his own section in this book. I mean, this is kind of where this history lands. So what role does Vladimir Putin play in shifting the way Russia deals with its compatriots?
Well, first of all, the idea to bring back some of the Russian emigres started with Putin's predecessor, with Yeltsin. He wanted to get people who, in a way, constituted the other Russia, the Russian community, which was not compromised with cooperation with communists. Yeltsin wanted to bring them to Russia to help to build a new democratic Russia. Putin's approach was completely different. He believed there should be only one Russia, guided from and ruled from Moscow. So what he wanted to do, he wanted to co-opt the Russians abroad and to make them part of his idea of big Russia run from Moscow. And to be honest, he was quite successful.
Yeah, I mean, is Putin using the kind of compatriot concept to build empire, or is he kind of driven by the same obsession and paranoia that Stalin was?
I would say both. Irina, what do you think?
Both, because on the one side, he is extremely scared of political emigres like Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
A billionaire tycoon and critic of the Kremlin has spent the last 10 years in jail on charges of tax evasion and embezzlement. Now he's a free man again after Putin signed a decree pardoning him.
On the other side, the Kremlin created a concept of Ruski Mir, or Russian world, which is a worldwide community of Russian-speaking people who connected by their identity to Russian culture and to Russian history. And Putin look at this community as his recruitment base.
Also, since we're in the current day, one of the people you frame this book around is journalist, activist, and politician Vladimir Kara-Murza. What is his story, and why did he become such a central character in your book?
Vladimir wanted to become a politician in Russia. And in 2007, 2008, liberal politicians were not extremely popular in Russia. And what we understood that nothing could be done from inside. So they decided to do something from outside. And they got the idea that sanctions against some personal Putin friends would be helpful. And of course, it angered Kremlin. The guy who was in charge of inventing the idea of personal sanctions, Boris Nemtsov, he was killed in 2015 right. In front of the Kremlin, actually.
Boris Nemtsov was walking with a woman on a bridge close to the Kremlin. A witness says a car stopped and several people shot him. Nemtsov, 55, was a prominent opposition leader.
Vladimir Kara-Murza was his assistant. And just a few months later, he himself was poisoned in Moscow. He barely survived. But he was so adamant to get back that just a few years later, in 2017, he got back to Russia. And he was poisoned again.
I can tell you it does take a long time after these incidents to get back to more or less normal, physically, psychologically, in many ways. I mean, after the first time I was poisoned in 2015, I had to learn to walk again physically. I had to learn to do so many things. Again, it's astonishing how quickly your body loses strength and loses...
The second time
everything.
He recovered faster. And again, he came back to Washington and he was healed there. The most interesting and completely surprising thing for me was that he decided to get back. And now he keeps going to Moscow because he told us that for the Russian politician, it's impossible to be out of Russia all the time.
Because, you know, I'm an opposition politician in Russia, and I think, you know, frankly, we don't have much choice. We are not happy about the direction that the Putin regime is taking our country. We're not happy.
And this is a new phenomenon we have now. The very first time in Russian history we have borders opened, so still people can travel, even the political exiles.
And the reason you focus on Vladimir Kara-Murza, is it because he kind of really underscores the cloak and dagger spying side of this whole compatriots idea?
It's also because we wanted to explain that sometimes you look at the activities of the Russian intelligence services in the West, for instance, in the UK, like poisoning of Sergei Skripal, and you think, wow, these guys are so incompetent, they're so sloppy, they must be just stupid. And it's not, unfortunately, the case. Sometimes part of the goal is to send an intimidating message.
To be intentionally stupid.
Exactly. And it happened with many cases from Skripal to Karamurza, and lots of people got this message. We understand that now we could be at risk, even if we live very far from Moscow.
Well, I was going to ask you, are you worried for Vladimir Karamurza's safety?
Yes, we are extremely worried about his safety, but he don't ask, and he's still traveling to Moscow.
Why did you two write this book?
Because political exiles found themselves in a very dangerous position, and we also understand that the Russian intelligence services and other security services, they're spying on them, and they're intimidating them, and they're even killing them.
And using them also.
That's what the reason why we decided to write the book on emigration.
Mm. And you wrote it in English, right? Yeah, and you're doing publicity for it in the United States now, so I'm really curious to know who is the audience. I mean, do Russians already know this?
So the thing is, we started writing about the FSB and the spy agencies in Russia back in 1999 and 2000. And by 2010, we understood that it would be extremely difficult to find a publisher in Russia. So thanks to some British friends and American friends, they got us connected with an American publisher. So now it's the way we operate. We write our book in English. When we wait passionately for usually for a year and a half, and then we could get a Russian publication where the byline is carefully kept, that it was first published in English somewhere. And that's our way to get back to our audience in Russia, which sounds very crazy, but that's how
it works out.
Have either of you been threatened?
Sure, absolutely. Sure, yeah. I mean,
as a result of your research on this book, or just other stuff?
Even when I had the conversation with one of the main protagonists of the book, a priest, he started our conversation saying, "Andrei, you have very powerful enemies," and so it's the way how you do these things. But to be honest, the very first time the FSB tried to intimidate us was back in 2002. Probably you remember back when we had a horrible terrorist attack. A theater was taken hostage. Right. So thanks to because of our reporting, we got interrogated, summoned to the prison, and our offices were raided. So it's a very long story for us.
Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borogan, thanks very much for speaking with us, and thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
That was my colleague Marco Werman speaking with Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borogan, authors of the new book, The Compatriots. You're with the world. President Trump has rolled back many environmental regulations. Now he's going after a big one, a landmark international climate agreement.
Diplomatically, what it means is that the U.S. is seen as an unreliable ally and an irresponsible leader.
Trump says the Paris Accord is a disaster, but is pulling out a disaster for the planet. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH in Boston, PRI and PRX. President Trump's agenda has been partially derailed by the impeachment inquiry, but when it comes to the environment, he's plowing ahead. On Monday, Trump is likely to move a step closer to delivering on a major campaign promise, getting out of the groundbreaking 2015 Paris Climate Change Accord. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
It didn't take President Trump long to make the big announcement in 2017. Just 5 months after taking office, Trump stood in the Rose Garden to say the U.S. was quitting the Paris Climate Accord.
As of today, the United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord and the draconian financial and economic burdens the agreement imposes.
The UN agreement rallied nearly every country in the world around the goal of keeping global warming under 2 degrees Celsius. President Trump sees it as a bad deal for the U.S., and he repeated his disapproval of the pact just last week at a shale gas conference in Pittsburgh.
I withdrew the United States from the terrible one-sided Paris Climate Accord. It was a total disaster for our country.
Based on these speeches, you'd be forgiven for thinking the U.S. has already withdrawn from the Paris Accord. But it actually hasn't.
So the United States is still what's referred to as a party to the agreement.
David Wasko from the World Resources Institute says U.S. negotiators are still attending U.N. climate summits. They even led negotiations last year to put one part of the Paris Agreement into practice. That's because there's a rule saying no country can leave the accord for its first 3 years.
So the first date that the president can send a letter withdrawing the United States is November 4th, 2019.
That's Monday. But even then, it's not over. Getting out of the pact will take a full year, meaning the U.S. won't finally and officially be finished with the Paris Agreement until November 4th, 2020, which just happens to be the day after the U.S. presidential election.
The irony here would be that the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement could take effect after an election result that might suggest a new administration that would move in a different direction. So there is certainly some potential irony there.
The U.S. has re-entered international organizations that it's left before. UNESCO, for example, the UN Cultural Organization. And all of the Democratic presidential candidates have said they would rejoin the Paris Agreement if they're elected. Longtime State Department lawyer Sue Biniaz says technically that would be easy to do.
The U.S. could rejoin on day one. I mean, several candidates have said that that would be their intention. And we would become a party again 30 days later, according to the terms of the Paris Agreement.
The tricky part would be setting a new carbon-cutting goal. Right now, the U.S. is on track to fall very short of what it promised in the Paris Agreement. And if the U.S. does rejoin the pact, it would have to set a new carbon target right away.
It's going to have to be a little bit of a Goldilocks target, because if it's too stringent, I don't think we'll have credibility. But if it's too unambitious, too realistic in a way, that could be kind of a downer. So exactly how you figure out what that target is, I think, will be an interesting challenge.
Now, if President Trump wins a second term next November, the future of the Paris Accord will look quite different. The U.S. will likely stay out of the agreement and no longer take part in U.N. climate meetings. Jennifer Tolman works on climate diplomacy for a think tank in Berlin and says this would represent a further isolation of the U.S. from the global community.
Diplomatically, what it means is that the U.S. is seen as an unreliable ally and an irresponsible leader.
If the U.S. remains outside the climate pact, other countries will need to cut emissions more and faster. Otherwise, they won't even come close to meeting the Paris Agreement's goals.
Everybody else then does need to do more, and the pressure does then fall particularly on the EU, and they are very aware of that.
It's not just the European Union. All eyes are also on China, the world's largest emitter. The U.S. and China once cooperated on climate change, but the two powers are in a trade war now. And it's unclear at this point which other countries might take the lead on addressing this global problem.
Really getting those other major polluters to step up is going to be crucial in the next period, because at the end of the day, you don't negotiate with nature.
And nature doesn't care about politics. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And just a quick follow-up to a story Carolyn reported earlier this week, that Chile would no longer host the UN's annual climate summit in December. Ongoing street protests forced Chile to make that decision. Well, the UN just announced that Madrid will now be stepping in to host. That means that 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg is looking for a ride. She sailed from Europe to the U.S. this summer with plans to extend her carbon-free journey down to Santiago. But now she's on the wrong side of the Atlantic. She tweeted today, "It turns out I've traveled half around the world the wrong way. If anyone could help me find transport, I would be so grateful." And in another corner of Twitter today, President Trump was busy. He sent out a flurry of tweets about the impeachment, including calling Democrats Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff corrupt politicians. What can get lost in all of the Washington impeachment news and name-calling is why the U.S. was sending nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine in the first place. Alexei Sorokin is with the Kyiv Post. Alexei, let's start with the basics. For Ukrainians, why does the relationship with the U.S. matter so much?
Well, the United States are our biggest ally in terms of sanctions towards Russia. And it's important for our country to have support from the West. And we heavily rely on financial aid and on the political support that the United States provide us.
And so the U.S. is important as the sort of counterweight to Russia, which Ukraine is always a little wary of?
Well, not a little. For the past 5 years, we're in an active conflict with Russia, and it's good to have somebody on our side.
So how do the impeachment proceedings in Washington impact that relationship?
Well, first of all, a lot of experts and politicians in Ukraine are wary of Ukraine being in the spotlight, but not for the right reason. And as President Zelensky pointed out during his 14-hour press conference, Ukraine doesn't want to take part in internal U.S. politics. And it's a big issue for us right now from Kyiv here.
Did you just say a 14-hour press conference?
Yes, it's 14-hour press conference. It was on October 10th.
Did it feel like 14 hours or was it actually 14 hours?
It was 14 hours. I'm not joking here. It's impossible to make this up.
Okay. So there are a couple new twists this week. Let's start with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman's testimony. He said one of his biggest concerns was that the politicization of aid could prejudice a future Democratic administration against Kyiv. How worrying is that for Ukraine?
Yes, that's a big issue for Ukraine, because if Ukraine makes any move concerning the impeachment probe, then we might lose the bipartisan support from the U.S., and it will damage substantially the U.S.-Ukraine relations. So for Ukraine, it's important that we stay out of it and that we're not pressured to put any effort into investigating the current president's political opponent.
The other twist this week is the Trump campaign's pushing back. I mean, painting Ukraine in some ways as a corrupt state. How is that going down in Ukraine?
Well, there is two sides to this issue. First of all, Ukraine does have a problem with corruption, and it's not a secret in Ukraine especially. But painting a U.S. ally as a corrupt state damages the trust between the Ukrainian and the U.S. administration. And it's important to be more diplomatic in this sense.
How much are Ukrainians following the whole drama going on in the U.S. right now over the impeachment proceedings against President Trump?
Not a lot, to be honest. In Ukraine, the current biggest issue is peace talks and disengagement in Ukraine's east. So Ukraine's attention, both media-wise and the public opinion, is concentrated on this issue. So I would say that this is not the biggest problem that Ukraine is currently facing.
Are Ukrainians bitter or resentful at the U.S. over the Trump administration holding up that aid, the military aid, that was going to fight the Russians in the eastern part of your country?
I don't know. I don't think that the general public knew that the U.S. was withholding military aid. It was mentioned by journalists, by some experts on this issue, but I don't think that most people in Ukraine knew that the U.S. was withholding military aid in the summer months.
And of course, that aid was eventually delivered. Alexei Sorokin of the Kyiv Post, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now the story of a Honduran family that finally got some good news. Beth Fertig is a senior reporter for WNYC. She's been following this family and told us how their journey to the U.S. got started.
So last year, in the summer of 2018, Anna Batiz and her daughters, Susan and Kirad, both teenagers, left Honduras and came to the U.S. border. Anna and Susan both have HIV. Kirad does not. Susan was 18 at the time, and because of that, Customs and Border Protection took her away from her mom and younger sister and sent her to adult detention. Anna and Kirad, however, were left to have an interview with an asylum officer to see if they qualified for asylum. They claimed HIV persecution, but Susan was not with them. She was still in an adult detention center. And when she was interviewed about whether she had a credible fear of returning, she failed the same test and was ultimately deported back to Honduras.
So they chose to leave Honduras because they're HIV positive, and as such, they were being persecuted, or the two of the three.
Yes. Anna was an HIV positive advocate, working on behalf of other people with HIV. She was known pretty well in Honduras, especially in her community, which is Garifuna. They are Black indigenous people who live on the coast, the Atlantic coast. They have the highest prevalence of HIV in Honduras. And people knew that her daughter, Susan, was also HIV positive. So Ana would be harassed and told, you know, that she's dirty and people didn't want to buy bread from her. Susan, when she would go to school, the kids were very, very cruel to her. They would beat her up. They would lock her in a bathroom and push her head in a filthy toilet. She and her sister Kirad told me about this. And it was such bad persecution that they couldn't go back to school.
So the big development this week for Ana is that on Tuesday, her asylum claim was approved. What was that day like for her and her family?
It was an amazing day for them because they had come to immigration court expecting to go through a trial, you know, to be asked a lot of questions, to prove that they really had suffered persecution. Their lawyer had prepared a file that was probably 10 inches thick with documentation on the persecution. And yet when they got to court, the government attorney did not put up any objection to granting them asylum. She said, I agree that they meet the burden for qualifying for asylum. And the judge said, I agree too. Welcome to America.
So I imagine that they wanted to get in touch with Susan back in Honduras pretty fast.
Oh, yeah, they did. As soon as they left the building, they called her. Kirad called. She told her the good news. She was so excited. And then she passed the phone to her mom so you can hear them all talking.
Hola, hija.
Hola, ma.
Pronto vas a estar con nosotros, ¿ok?
Sí, mami.
¿Estás alegre?
Sí, mami.
Se logró, Susa. Yo te dije que confiaras. ¿Verdad que sí?
Sí, mami.
Pronto te voy a dar un abrazo bueno.
And that was Ana basically telling Susan, see, I told you we'd win, and I can't wait to see you. When I do, I'm going to give you such a big hug.
So how soon can she bring Susan to the U.S.?
Her lawyer says that she's applying right away to bring her as a dependent. Susan's applied for her own Honduran passport so she can come, but it could take up to a year because it's kind of backlogged. It's a difficult thing to do.
Now, my big question is, if Ana and Susan presented nearly identical asylum cases to U.S. officials, how could one be approved and not the other?
It really shows the randomness of the process and how it depends on each individual and the asylum officer that they encounter. So for Ana, it was a very easy process. She was, you know, interviewed and let go the very next day to go on to New York with her younger daughter, Kirad. But Susan, who was in a detention center for several weeks before she was interviewed, she's there by herself. She's never been apart from her mom before. She didn't know what to say at all. I think there were some communication problems when I looked at the transcript. But at one point she was asked, did you ever get help from the police? And she acknowledged that there was a police officer who helped her once. And that seemed to negate the whole story, that by saying that a police officer helped her, she didn't have grounds for asylum. And I spoke to several experts who said they were kind of mixed on this. Some said, well, that asylum officer should have asked additional questions. You know, where was her mom and what else happened after the police officer helped you? Others said, well, that was enough. The asylum officer didn't have to go any further. So it's up to the individual asylum officer if they're going to try to put that in a bigger context. And Christina Velez, Ana's attorney, believes that this is part of a bigger issue right now, and that the Trump administration, with its very hardline immigration policies, is discouraging asylum officers from letting people in.
What we're seeing with Susan versus Ana is the outcome of that pressure, I think. And the outcome is inconsistent adjudications. And we see that someone who was turned away, who shares many of the same facts as Ana, was perhaps wrongly turned away.
And we were talking at a diner after the family won asylum, and you know, Christina said it shows how irrational it can often seem.
Beth Fertig is a senior reporter for WNYC. Thanks a lot, Beth.
You're welcome.
Afghanistan has been at war for 18 years, but the fighting is reaching new levels of brutality. Attacks on medical facilities, extrajudicial executions, and other violations of international humanitarian law. Some of these atrocities are allegedly being committed by Afghan paramilitaries trained by the CIA. That's according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. Patricia Gossman is the report's author.
First, it's important to understand that the CIA has been running essentially a parallel counterinsurgency operation in Afghanistan since 2001. And in that, they have enabled, armed, trained, supplied, worked with these paramilitary forces initially to hunt al-Qaeda. But what we have seen in the last, especially 2 years, year and a half, 2 years, is a sort of expansion of that. And there's now several new units that are designed to go after Islamic State groups and increasingly the Taliban.
And these are Afghans. These are Afghan troops trained by the CIA.
Yes, yes. These are Afghans who are working outside the normal chains of command of the Afghan Defense Forces and also outside of the U.S. military normal chains of command.
And the kinds of things you found evidence of are?
Essentially, it's these night raids. They go to villages. Mostly this happens in rural areas of Afghanistan. Come in the middle of the night, usually between midnight and 3 a.m., and summarily shoot people and detain some of them without informing the family where they're being held, which is an enforced disappearance.
Give us an example, because that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, the first case I came across was out in Nangarhar province, which is to the east. And it was an old man who came to talk to me about this incident that happened in his village where these forces arrived by helicopter, were dropped in the village, blew up the gate of his compound, came in, shot two of his brothers, shot a nephew, and then detained his son. No explanation. He's been searching for his son ever since. The other incidents that we've included in the report are attacks on medical care, basically clinics that are accused of treating Taliban fighters and are subjected to attacks. The medical staff have been beaten and in some cases killed. Even if they were fighters in some cases, you cannot shoot a prisoner in custody. They can take them, they can detain them, they can question them. You can't just shoot somebody in your custody. That's a war crime.
I guess one thing I want to clarify is that the CIA, who is directing these Afghan military who are operating under them, what operations to undertake, or are these CIA-trained Afghan soldiers making those decisions themselves?
I think that's a very good question. And the problem is there's not enough transparency about these operations to know. What we'd like to see is more accountability so that that question becomes clear, particularly to the people who are affected by these night raids.
Now, the CIA says it takes these allegations seriously and they're going to thoroughly review what you've written. But in a statement, the agency says your claims are likely false or exaggerated. They point to past reviews of similar allegations and suggest, you know, they kind of suggest you've been played by the Taliban propaganda machine.
Well, yeah, they say they've investigated these in the past. We've seen no evidence that they've ever held anyone accountable. And some of these incidents have been investigated by other groups other than ourselves, including media. And, you know, they have also corroborated these accounts. Some of these clinics, you know, the clinic staff, they're run by international NGOs, and they know that these raids have happened. Their staff have been beaten up or in some cases killed. And these are international NGOs who vouch for their own staff. And yet, even in those cases, no investigations have taken place.
The CIA statement that I mentioned also affirms the U.S. commitment to the rule of law and says it doesn't condone or knowingly participate in illegal activities. What do you want the U.S. to do in response to your report?
Well, we know that some groups, including the UN and the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, have been trying to investigate these incidents to get to the bottom of them, to give some redress to the victims. We would like the U.S. to cooperate with these investigations so that the truth comes out. They say they want to hold their forces accountable and abide by the rule of law. This is the way they can do it.
Patricia Gossman authored the new report from Human Rights Watch that details suspected abuses by U.S.-backed forces in Afghanistan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This weekend marks the end of daylight savings time, so next week, look forward to lighter mornings and much darker afternoons. Twice a year, there's a collective grumble about the change, with lots of requests to eliminate it. Today, we're talking to someone who doesn't just want to eliminate daylight savings, but time zones entirely. Steve Hanke is an economist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Steve, what do you mean, abolish all time zones? How would that work?
If we abolished all time zones, it would work very easily. We'd all set our watches at exactly the same time, everyone in the world. Now, what would that time be? It would be what's referred to as universal time, or what we used to call Greenwich Mean Time.
Now, of course, you know what I'm going to ask next, which is that some of the world would be in the dark and some would be in the light. And how do we go about our working days? How does that work?
The working day is easy to take care of because, for example, China right now is the leader in the sense that it's a huge country, but they only have one time zone. But when they go to work and when they go to sleep and so forth, they set the local time relative to where the sun is in the sky. So they come up with whatever is convenient in the locality, but their watches would always be on the same hour.
What are the benefits of this idea?
Scheduling is one obvious thing, but there are other things that are associated with it. There are a lot of safety provisions. For example, since 1972, all airlines and every airport in the world operates on Greenwich Mean Time. And if they didn't do that, there'd be enormous safety problems because there'd be confusion about actually what time it was.
I assume you get a lot of pushback on this. What do people say to you?
Not really. There's essentially no pushback because it's happening spontaneously. We are adopting universal time as we speak.
If we had the universal time zone, how would we know what people are doing in another country if we couldn't automatically calculate to what time of day it was for them? I mean, China's 12 hours ahead. Don't we have to calculate anyway?
Well, there would be a calculation. You'd know that you were calling them at the same time on your watch, but you wouldn't know whether it was light or dark, whether they were sleeping or working and so forth. So you have on your iPhone a globe that shows you where it's light, where it's dark. You see these obviously and use them when you're on an airplane, for example. It'll have a picture of the world and you'll see where it's dark and where it's light.
Steve Hanke is an economist at Johns Hopkins University. He's been speaking to us from Paris. Thanks a lot.
And thank you. And switch the clock.
Okay.
Okay. Good deal. Bye-bye.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back at the same time on Monday. But what is time anyway?
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.